Hello and welcome to another episode of Gemstone Mine. I'm John.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Jake.
And we promised you last time when we finished talking about the new gods from Kaldheim that we would come back and tell you what's in our cart for this new set. Well, the full spoiler's out, and we're going to tell you the cards that are most interesting to us. Again, our What's in Your Cart episode is not a typical set review episode. We're not looking to do a deep card-by-card dive on the entire set. We're looking to talk about which singles are the ones that we are most interested to pick up when the set releases. We may miss some of the cards that interest you are going to be popular, or even commanders that may be number one on EDH Rec. But that's because we're looking at a tiny slice of the commander metagame, the one that's happening at our tables. Before we get to that, though, there's a little bit of news that's happened since last we recorded. For one thing, I can finally play Arena.
Hooray! Yeah,
finally joined the rest of us.
Arena is officially testing on Android now, so that's cool.
Or early release, or I'm not exactly sure what they're calling it, but it is mostly playable. That said, it did take me over 7 hours to actually get it to install.
Yikes. I'm interested to see how it is. I've played a couple mobile games like Hearthstone and Eternal and stuff on my phone, and it's cramped, and Magic is a little more involved than those, so I'm curious how it works on phones. I can see it on tablets to be pretty manageable.
So I have it installed on my Chromebook at the moment. I have zero issues in terms of screen real estate. I've not run into any of those issues yet. And what wound up happening for me while I was installing it was that it would try to download, you know, half a gigabyte of data to update the client. And it would download maybe 100 megabytes. Then it would crash and say it disconnected. And it just happened over and over and over. To the point where eventually I just put it down for an hour, came back and tried to do it again. Eventually it got there. But it was kind of like I had to keep rolling until I got a natural 20.
Yeah, definitely some growing pains ahead.
It seems par for course for releases like this, though. Hopefully it gets better once it gets out of alpha and gets into actual. It's like, hey, it's out. Everyone can use it now, and it's stable. Hopefully it'll be the same kind of experience we have on PC. That way you can play with us, or stream with us, or just understand the nonsense that Jake and I talk about when we're drafting, or me playing Brawl, or something. The more the merrier.
There's still a few features that are very limited. I can't actually redeem codes through it. I have to go to the janky Wizards of the Coast Arena website and redeem the little pack codes through there. And they don't always, like, work. So I'm just going to ask you guys, the pre-release cards. We're going to talk about our experience trying to get the pre-release together this weekend. But our local store sold a deal where you could buy multiple pre-release kits. So you could do your own pre-release kits at home at your kitchen tables. Are you not able to actually enter multiple pre-release kit codes into Arena?
It's just a one-time thing.
Got it.
It seems that way because I've got six codes.
So you can give me one of your extras.
You got it, Jake.
It would be nice to end up with 24 packs based off of our pre-order, but apparently Arena says otherwise.
That's how, I think that's how Pokemon does it. Like, when you buy a physical pack of cards, there is a code in there to redeem for a digital pack of cards for every single pack, which would be pretty cool. But that's not how Wizards is doing it.
True. The other issue seems to be there's still some hiccups with sideboarding in the Android client. I do not yet have enough cards to actually build a constructed deck, I don't have enough gold saved up to actually do a draft yet, so I don't know exactly how sideboarding works, but apparently there are some issues with it still. Outside of Arena, there is a little bit more going on in the Magic electronic space.
Magic Legends. I was fortunate enough to get into the early access for it. Unfortunately, NDA means I can't talk about it. But what has been revealed in, you know, different websites and whatnot as to how the game's going to work, it definitely could use some polish. It's not there yet, but the way the mechanics work and the way your planeswalker uses abilities, there's promise. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, there's been a couple videos that they've released to kind of drum up interest in it, and it looks like a take on an action RPG along the lines of, like, Diablo or Path of Exile. So, we'll see how it shapes up.
And speaking, I guess, of the pre-release games we've played, unfortunately, due to technical difficulties, we were not able to get our personal pre-release housewarming party together yet.
Yeah, I have a whole bunch of, like, food waiting downstairs I bought for yesterday that, unfortunately, I'm going to have to end up eating myself.
Nah, just lock it in the freezer.
Too late. There's a tray of Cuban sandwiches that's already half of it's missing already.
Oh, well, I'm gonna have to then chip in next time to get some of those sandwiches for us for our proper housewarming pre-release event. Shout out to Dungeon Games in Fort Myers, Florida again. They did a really cool deal where for a similar price to a box, you would wind up buying X number of pre-release kits so you could recreate that pre-release experience back at home. Looking forward to doing this. I still saved a few of those pre-release kits for next weekend.
I have one that I have not cracked the packs. I did open it because I went looking for my arena card, only to then realize you can only enter one at a time. Because I got really excited to just throw those packs in and see what kind of new things I can build in Brawl without having to use my wild cards. And then it's like, oh great, I've got all these extra arena codes that I can't use. So there's that. It's still sealed, still usable. I just have this code that I can't use.
Ah, well.
Yeah, I haven't gotten any physical cards, but I have been drafting Kaldheim. I've done 5 drafts, I think, and I'm doing better than usual, which is kind of exciting and also weird. But yeah, it's been enjoyable.
You might be in that phase that LSV and Marshall always talk about, where just being the more up-to-date and knowledgeable player about Limited in general means you have an edge early on when the casuals like me come out of the woodwork to draft for a little while before they crawl back out into the shadows.
I think that could be part of it. Like, there's a lot of fancy play syndrome, I think, going on. I see people foretelling a whole bunch of stuff and doing all kinds of stuff, and I'm just playing crappy 3/2s and hitting them and killing them, and cards that affect the board.
They tend to be good. Well, speaking of cards that tend to be good, have you guys been making any updates to your decks? Any new building? Any new tweaking that's been going on? Jake, you've been doing a little bit of work, I think.
So I finally got around to updating some of my CEDH decks. I got the Tempo Nigila list tweaked and updated. Wasn't a whole lot of differences there, mostly just adding some stuff from Commander Legends that I have been very behind the times on getting in. And then I spent a little bit of time putting together a Turgrid list because I got excited by that card. We'll talk about it later. And I had an old Hapatra list from, God, I don't know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago maybe, that I dusted out and started updating, and it might put that into a paper format and get it ready to play.
Very cool. Alex, are you doing any updates or builds or dusting the cards back off after the move?
Dusting? So I actually took every one of my decks apart with the exception of my Winota CDH deck that I can just pick up and play, but the cards in it don't occupy any other space in terms of other decks that I'm using, so there's no harm in leaving it together in its box, just sitting there until it's time to be used. But I haven't played in a while, and while I had like a high keen interest on like my Omnath Landfall deck and things of that nature, like we never got out to using it, so that momentum kind of just waned. So I figured a good way to do that was I was going through my cards, I was resorting, selling off what I could. Post move, I want to spend store credit for new cards as much as possible. But I figured it'd be a good time to kind of go through each of the decks, maybe rebuild some classics. I'm thinking about putting Taysa back together, and then just kind of seeing what the lay of the land where my cards are, and then kind of building from there and see what kind of tickles my interests. So I dusted them off before I put them away, so that's a thing.
I've managed to finish building a teamer deck with Chrom, Ludovic's Opus, and Kadama of the East Tree as a landfall deck. I am looking forward to trying that one out. In Goldfishing, it does some pretty dumb things with Field of the Dead. Then I also finally completed my cycle of monocolored decks with Sakashima of a Thousand Faces and Malcolm Keen-Eyed Navigator in my deck that I'm calling Oops, All Malcolm. Where I just keep casting clones of Sakashima, who is a clone of Malcolm, so whenever any of them hits, I get just exponentially increasing numbers of treasure to play exponentially stupider giant blue spells.
Mono blue ramp. Okay.
So, as is tradition, before we actually get into what is in our cart, there's a few honorable mentions that we always try to bring up, and in this case, it's going to be the completion of the Pathway cycles. So, the Pathways were a series of 6 cards that originally came out of Zendikar Rising. These were kind of the showcase of the double-faced modular card design, where on one side it is a land that enters the battlefield untapped, it is non-basic, non-typed, and it taps for a single color of mana. And then on the opposite side, another land that enters the battlefield untapped taps for a single color of mana, also non-types. This cycle has been completed in the new Kaldheim set with the four, not even enemy-colored ones, I believe. We have the Azorius pathway. Hengegate pathway is white on one side, blue on the other. We have the Golgari pathway. Darkbore pathway, which is black on one side and green on the other. We have the Rakdos pathway, that is Blightseep step pathway, which is black on one side, red on the other. And Bark Channel pathway is the Simic pathway. Green on one side, blue on the other.
I have put the black-green one into the Hypatra list that I was toying around with. But other than that, they're either running enough colors that I can just get by with, you know, the ridiculous mana base of fetches, duels, shocks, and five-color lands. Yeah, I think they'll come in handy for the, like, two-color Tainted Pact decks for me. Otherwise, you can't fetch them, and they don't have types, so I might not use them quite often.
So why don't we just start right straight away with our colorless cards that are in our cart. Pyre of Heroes is a 2-mana artifact. It has the ability to tap, sacrifice a creature. Search your library for a creature card that shares a creature type with the sacrificed creature, and has a converted mana cost equal to 1 plus that creature's converted mana cost. Put that card onto the battlefield, then shuffle your library. Activate this ability only at any time you could cast a sorcery. So it is a tribal, colorless Birthing Pod. That is a lot of restrictions on Birthing Pod. Honestly, this is probably going to go into some of my decks that are running Scrap Trawler just because so many components of those lines are constructs like Scrap Trawler itself. And being able to go from a 2-drop construct into a 3-drop Scrap Trawler into potentially a 4-drop like Mindless Automaton, which triggers Scrap Trawler nicely on its death.
Yeah, I haven't really thought about what I want to do with it. Like, being the tribal player, you'd imagine that I would have more to do with it. But honestly, nothing really comes to mind. Like, if I want Birthing Pod-like effects, I will just play Birthing Pod.
One thing that, like, with time, I'm sure people will come up with more Pyre of Hero chains that you can do. It doesn't necessarily have to be restricted to one tribe. Like, you can run this in something other than just elf deck or wizard deck, because you could sacrifice an elf wizard to go get a wizard, and then sacrifice your human wizard to go get a human whatever, so that you can do some chains. I think it definitely involves more hoops to jump through than your traditional, like...
Outside of chains, like, not looking at it as a competitive, like, how degenerate can I be with this? Looking at it in terms of, hey, I just want to do something with it to generate value. If there are 5-color Tazri decks running around that are looking at the party mechanic, I can see it taking place there, sacrificing a rogue or a cleric or one of the green creatures that dips into all of them to look for something that kind of better fits the niche. I can see it maybe showing up there to kind of double dip into things where you can take advantage of multiple creature types, multiple tribes you can kind of go and fetch.
Moving along from colorless then, why don't we get started with some white cards? So this is one of the cards that is getting a lot of, I guess, hype. Doomscar is 3 white-white for a sorcery. It reads, destroy all creatures, but it also has foretell. Its foretell cost, after you have paid 2 to exile it, is 1 white-white. So a 3 CMC sweeper.
I mean, it's... The 5 mana cost offsets it for things like Day of Judgment or Wrath of God. However, the foretell cost for just to let you kind of get it out of your hand, which, you know, I think it's something that should be touched on. Have in more competitive formats, hand disruption is a thing that exists. Being able to foretell something, know that you have this card A at the ready, B safe from being pulled from your hand, and C at a reduced casting cost makes it appealing, especially since foretell cards are hidden from your opponents. So while I can assume that a Doomscar or wipe is coming, you could just, if you've got the poker face sword, just bluff it with any other foretell card that you may be running in white, and it may change how they play, because they're just like, oh, well, there's a 3-mana Wrath hiding right over there, so...
I think the aggressive costing, again, being a 3-mana sweeper, that really opens up options for you to be able to be the first person to start rebuilding after the sweeper.
I think this is probably one of the strongest 5 CMC sweepers out there. If I was building a deck that wanted multiple sweepers, I'd start with like Wrath and Day of Judgment and Damnation and Toxic Deluge, that kind of stuff, just because it's cheaper. But this would be the first one I would add that is over 4 CMC.
The other thing that I think will kind of play out with this is how many cards with foretell wind up being playable in the format. Alex, you mentioned a moment ago that one of the potential strengths for it is if you have the poker face for it demanding your opponents to guess what the card is can change a lot of variables. If this is the only card with Foretell that winds up seeing play in Commander, it's essentially play to 2-mana board wipe that's sitting on the stack in Suspend, ready to go off at your whim. I better start sandbagging now. If, on the other hand, there are 5 or 6 cards in the format that are playable board wipe, or just playable Foretell effects, the counterplay becomes more interesting. Just like every time they print more interesting morph cards, the counterplay gets more interesting.
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention. It's the same effect as morph. Like, when morph first came out, I don't think there were that many, like, constructed non-EDH formats. There weren't that many really viable ones, so you couldn't really plop down a morph creature and be like, hoo-hoo, I bet you don't know what this is. It's like, yeah, that's whatever that 4-5 lifelink angel is. It's literally the only morph that anybody plays in constructed.
Well, so my whole thing is, like, it's kind of like a Nevermore's Disc then. It's like, you play Nev's Disc, it's on the battlefield, everyone knows it's there, so your opponents have the option to play into it and hope that someone can answer Nev's Disc, or they sandbag and hold as much as they can in fear of playing into a Nev's Disc.
That's true, but you could also just say, hey, I have Wrath of God in my hand.
Yeah, but this way people are like, no. It's like, I've got a Wrath. No, you don't. I mean, there's only one Foretell card in the format, and here it is. I have a Wrath in my hand. What are you going to do?
Yeah, I guess that's true. Kind of whatever direction the format winds up taking with Foretell cards being played, it's going to be in an interesting space. I do plan to pick one up for Oketra. It's just an aggressively costed board wipe. It'll replace one of the other board wipes in the deck, most likely. And it may be the only Foretell card I run in that deck, but so be it. Just being able to pay 3 mana to wipe the board and then start rebuilding right away with cards I'm getting back from Scrap Trawler. That's kind of where I would like to be with my board wipes.
Also, it's Oketra, so you can make room in there.
Pretty easily. Well, Alex, you've got a card here you want to talk about. A card we talked about a little bit last week.
It is Halvar, God of Battle. So we talked about it a bit last week. It is one of the Modal Dual Face God cards from the set. On the party side, it is a legendary god creature. It gives your other enchanted creatures double strike. And at the beginning of combat, if an equipment is attached to one creature, I can then freely move it to another. So in Voltron decks, most of the good equipment that exists out there is relatively expensive. And there are ways to cheat it into play or cheat it onto creatures. So having another redundant way to do that, Halvar himself being a creature that it can be equipped from, it is just kind of approaching that critical mass of effects for Voltron decks of being able to quickly and cheaply attach an artifact to a creature. On the flip side of it, if you just want to have just another artifact to attach to a beater, the flip side of Halvar, the Sword of the Realms, just gives it a standard. Here's +2/+0 with vigilance. And the added bonus of whenever the creature it's attached to dies, I can return it to the hand. So it's a shoring up of the Voltron-esque effect where you suit up a creature and then it just gets Path of Exiled.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, you have talked me up on it from the initial spoiling of it. Let me put it that way.
Also, the Viking art just looks badass. So
the showcases are so good in this set.
Yeah, I really, really like the showcase frame and the art direction, which is just really cool. Can't wait to pick up some.
Absolutely. Well, the next card I want to talk about is going to just come down just a little bit from the excitement of Halvar and Doomscar. And I want to mention a card from my Aura Tribal Clerics deck, and that is Righteous Valkyrie. So Righteous Valkyrie is 2 and a white for a 2/4 creature angel cleric with flying. Whenever another angel or cleric enters the battlefield under your control, you gain life equal to that creature's toughness. As long as you have at least 7 life more than your starting life total, creatures you control get +2/+2. So Alex, when we were live brewing that deck together, one of the things we identified as a potential win condition were some potential like anthem-like effects. And Righteous Valkyrie does the front half that the deck wants to do with a Soul Sisters type effect, as the entire deck is going to be clerics. And it also provides a anthem effect, where it will give all your creatures, including itself, +2/+2, as long as I can hit 47 life.
It does. 2 things about it. 1, it blocks Timna, most importantly.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. We check off our meme for today.
We do. The thing that actually makes it the most appealing, aside from its, small book of text on the front of it, is the fact that it's only 3 mana. Aura triggers off of his own trigger, which means it actually can get Righteous Valkyrie back. So it's one of those cards that if it happens to bite the bullet relatively early on, it's not gone forever because it is costed to the sense where it could be recurred.
Yes, which definitely fits well with Aura, and you are correct, since Aura it triggers off of its own death. Yeah, Aura will go to the graveyard before it goes to the command zone. Well, why don't we move out of white? Maybe we can coax Jake out of his silence for a while. And why don't we move into the color of blue? I'm going to get us started with just a role player in Bind the Monstrous. It is an enchantment aura for a single blue mana. Bind the Monstrous is an enchant creature. When it enters the battlefield, tap enchanted creature. It deals damage to you equal to its power. Enchanted creature doesn't untap during its controller's untap step. So this is the cheapest version of this claustrophobia effect that we've seen so far. It is a single blue mana to potentially tap down a creature permanently. A creature that's dependent on being able to tap to use an activated ability, or a creature who is intended to be built up to be a big attacker. This is one of the cheaper ways in blue to get rid of it. I don't think it would take the place of something like Pognify or Rapid Hybridization in blue. I don't think it would take the place of something like Chain of Vapor in blue. But it's another very cheaply costed, admittedly sorcery speed answer to a single threat.
I mean, it is costed for them, and that's the biggest thing, is that effect does exist. The question is, where would you want something like that?
If I'm playing mono blue, I'm looking at this as a potential way to get those handful of flyers or reach creatures out of the way of my Malcolm deck.
And it is costed. Like, it is efficient.
Yeah, if this were two mana, this would not have made the list, but the fact that it's one mana, you have to take notice of it.
It's also a way of shutting down those couple Voltron decks that are still floating around in our meta.
I mean, Korvold, Grevin.
All right, so the next one on our list is Mystic Reflection. It is an instant for one generic and a blue. The text is, choose target non-legendary creature. The next time one or more creatures or planeswalkers enter the battlefield this turn, they enter as copies of the chosen creature, and it has Foretell for a single blue. So this is a pretty flexible card. You can either use it as a form of removal, where somebody's playing one of the big threatening pieces, and you can just play Mystic Reflection in response and turn it into like a Llanowar Elf or some kind of little dirtly token that's out. You can also use it to copy someone's existing creature that's out in play with one of your own spells. So if there's a Dockside or
Thassa's Oracle.
Thassa's Oracle, Gilded Drake, any of that kind of stuff, you can effectively copy that with one of your own mana dorks. Yeah, it's one of those really flexible and cheap pieces that in any one of those circumstances wouldn't really be worth a card, but with enough of them combined into a single card, it could have an impact.
And it's not just those. You've mentioned that there are scenarios of probably excess that you don't normally get up to with the way that you build decks. But if you're having many tokens enter the battlefield as part of a single trigger or a single effect, Mystic Reflection will turn all of those tokens into a copy of whatever it is you point Mystic Reflection at.
Yeah, if you ever wanted to be like the Supreme Gardener, you could play Avenger of Zendikar, and then when all the plant creation triggers are on the stack, just play Mystic Reflection, point it at your Avenger of Zendikar. So all your plants will come in as Avenger of Zendikar, and they would all make plants. It gets to be kind of like, oh my God, what's the movie with the plant?
Little Shop of
Yes, Little Shop of
Horrors.
Horrors. Yes. But yeah, just pay attention to the wording on the token generators, because Avenger of Zendikar, Master of Waves, those kind of things that create a bunch of tokens at once would work. But things like Najila is a bunch of individual single triggers, so it would only make one.
Right. Yeah, the fact that this is both a pretty powerful form of removal, essentially you're Okoing, you're Elking something. Or you are upgrading one of your own things into something that is much better, potentially. Or you are doing something silly and over the top at a very low cost.
Speaking of Oko, it can hit planeswalkers, which normally isn't a huge relevance, but there are a couple more planeswalkers seeing play lately. So what you do is you would play this target like a Llanowar Elf while John is trying to cast his planeswalker. And then what will happen is Tevish Zot will come into play as a copy of Llanowar Elf.
Gotcha. All right. Now I understand it. I didn't really look at this card too hard. But, okay, now you honestly piqued my attention by saying all of the Avenger of Zendikar cards, which... my small elf brain just kind of twigged to that. I'm just like, oh, okay, there might be things there. Maybe I should put Omnath back together for reasons.
What's the mirror ball? Oh, mirror battle sphere. That could also work. You make a mirror battle sphere, it makes 4 mirror tokens. You turn all those into mirror battle spheres, you get 16 mirror tokens, and then they can, like, nuke people.
Now, would those additional tokens come in as the original copies, or no, because it's a different instance?
It's a different instance.
It's just the next time one or more creatures enter the battlefield. So the first trigger of the Mirror Battlesphere making the tokens would fulfill that. So Mystic Reflection would turn those into Mirror Battlespheres. Those would enter, and then they would just make their own normal 1/1 mirror tokens.
It also, worth noting, it is 2 mana, so you could totally put it under an Isochron Scepter if you wanted to.
That's true, yeah.
Just call it Shark Stick.
Oh god, get out of here. All right, John, what's the next card? Just go.
Orval, the All Form, is a legendary creature shapeshifter. It is a 3/3 for 3 generic and 1 blue mana, total of 4 mana. It is a changeling. Whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell, if it targets one or more other permanents you control, create a token that's a copy of one of those permanents. Whenever a spell or ability an opponent controls causes you to discard this card, create a token that's a copy of target permanent. So I'm looking at this card and I'm really interested in it. Number one, the awesome showcase art is just really cool. Once again, they just killed it with these album cover arts. But Orvar, I want to put right into my Oops All Malcolm deck. It is probably going to replace one of the 5 CMC clones. It does not do a good job of cloning itself, but having Changeling means it is also a pirate that can chip in to get me more treasures on somebody who is open. And the second line of text, the response to my creatures being targeted with instant or sorcery spells, I have a number of clone effects in the deck where just because they are cheap, I am running things like Cackling Counterpart, the 3 mana clone spell. And it may make me look at more of those as ways to get cheap copies of Sakashima, who is copying Malcolm in the deck. It would just mean I would have an exponentially quicker way to get more Malcolms and thus get more treasure. Also of note, Orvar is just a strict upgrade to anyone who is playing a Mistform Ultimus deck.
So that covers all the blue cards. I guess we're going to be moving on to black now.
Yes. Jake, this is your favorite color, but before we get to your favorite cards, I want to give a quick shout out to one of the cards from the Commander decks for the set. Pact of the Serpent kind of fills the role of those 2 and 3 CMC black cards that are pay some life, draw some cards. Pact of the Serpent is 1 and 2 black mana for a sorcery. Choose a creature type. Target player draws X cards and loses X life, where X is the number of creatures they control of the chosen type. I like this because I've always felt that cards like Minion's Murmurs at 4 mana, where you draw X cards and lose X life, where X is the number of creatures you control, is a very powerful draw effect in a lot of creature-based black decks. The advantage to this is being cheaper is cool. Being a card that directly supports tribal-type decks is, again, that's always something that's cool to see. And having the highest potential ceiling on both sides of being able to draw you a bunch of cards, or have the more realistic version of killing somebody with your draw spell. I mean, I have never actually managed to kill someone with Sign and Blood before.
See, like, I see where you're coming from that. I wish it was the other way around, though. Like, I wish they, like, the word they could just be, like, crossed out of this card, and I would be more on board with it. Because playing in the decks that I would enjoy it, elves or vampires are the two that come to mind personally. I run a relatively high risk of drawing a lot of cards and also hitting myself in the face for a lot. However, I would also like it to be like, cool, I have a bunch of rise triggers with a bunch of elf tokens. John, draw your deck. Without the they, I want to be able to sit there and either kill somebody with life total damage or deck themselves with this.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I shouted this one out because I do really like this card and I do plan to pick it up for my black decks. Like, Aura is going to get this card. Just, it seems like a great way to draw a ton of cards and potentially incidentally have a way to occasionally kill an opponent with it. The next card I wanted to talk about was Dream Devourer. This is a creature demon cleric. It is a 0/3 for 1 and a black. Each non-land card in your hand without Foretell has Foretell. Its Foretell cost is equal to its mana cost reduced by 2. So essentially, you're going to wind up paying the same total cost for any card you would want to play, but you get to break it up over multiple turns. And then it has another ability. Whenever you foretell a card, Dream Devourer gets +2/+0 until end of turn. So I want this card mostly just to try it out in Aura, where it could synergize a little bit with cards like Doomscar, as I can at least try to hide the fact I have a board wipe among cards that I've exiled. But I feel like the place where it would be most potentially powerful is banking cards away before you start wheeling. So in some kind of like Grixis Shell, something like that, where you know you're going to want to wheel, you don't have a lot of cheap cards, and you're just going to put those other cards on layaway to play later, get your hand down, and then get a payoff with Windfall.
Yeah, this is one of those cards that's a cool effect, and it would be neat to play, but I don't think I'm going to.
Yeah.
One thing that I had to look up because I was a little unsure, once you have Dream Devourer out and foretell a card from your hand, even if somebody removes the Dream Devourer, you can still play your foretelled cards.
Right. Well, Jake, there is another demon that we both want to talk about, but I think you should get us started with this one.
All right, so the next one up is Varagoth, Blood Sky Sire. This is a legendary demon rogue for 2 generic and a black. It is a 2/3 with Death Touch, and it has Boast. For 1 generic and a black, target player searches their library for a card, then shuffles their library and puts that card on top of it. And I don't think we've talked about Boast yet. So basically you can activate this ability if the creature has attacked, and only once that turn. So this is another top of library tutor. That's, you know, good. Tutoring is good. It's kind of on an evasive body in that it's a 2/3 death touch. So most people aren't going to want to throw something in front of it to block it. But at the same time, it's important enough that they will want to kill it. So you'll usually get some decent trade out of it if they do block. And Opposition Agent works well with it, which is not much of a surprise. So instead of being a top of deck tutor for you, it turns into a Praetor's Grasp where you just steal it out of somebody's library and have access to it that turn.
Yeah. I personally just like that it's just really cheap. It's easy to cheat into play. Like in any... I've mentioned that I kind of want to build another Golgari deck or some other Golgari plus color deck at some point. And the fact that you can just Eldritch Evolution any one mana dork into this, or Neoform any other number of 2 converted mana cost creatures into this, it's a relatively consistent creature to get out and make a more central part of your game plan. Again, it's just interesting. I'm loving the design space in this set.
Also, the showcase art looks awesome. That's just a trend.
Oh, I think we could just have that be my new ringtone at this point. Well, the next one has even, I might say, prettier showcase art.
I agree. So this is Turgrid, God of Fright. She is a 4/5 menace for 3 generic and 2 black, a legendary god. Whenever an opponent sacrifices a non-token permanent or discards a permanent card, you may put that card from a graveyard onto the battlefield under your control. And it is one of the modal double face cards, so the backside is Turgrid's Lantern. For 3 generic and a black, it's a legendary artifact. With tap, target player loses 3 life, unless they sacrifice a non-land permanent or discard a card. And for 3 generic and a black, you can untap Turgrid's Lantern. So I talked about this a little bit in the second of our gods episode, about some things that I was looking to do with it. The front side basically just has synergy with a bunch of stuff that black already does, like the sacrifice and discard. The back side is an infinite mana outlet that will just win you the game. I think these are really cool. I like the card. I don't know if it's quite there yet. As a commander, the options for infinite mana in black are kind of rough. I think it just has a little bit more something in an upcoming set. This could go there for me. But as is, I might toss it in the 99 of a few decks just because it's cool.
I also like it. While people are calling it a salty commander, I kind of mentioned last time that I feel like Turgrid has a very clear path to ending the game. Once Turgrid gets going and establishes a soft lock, it is probably going to be very unbalanced very quickly and quickly snowball into a position where Turgrid is going to either be answered or run away with it.
And I've actually seen a version of like an Opus Thief style deck that uses a bunch of wheels, and it uses Turgrid as one of the payoffs,
Oh God, yes.
which is really interesting. I don't know if it's better than, the other good ones, but that seems like when it works, it would be pretty backbreaking.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that's the end of black. Do we want to move into red?
That sounds like a pretty good idea. So the first card we have here, I'll just kick us off with Magda, Brazen Outlaw. It is one and a red for a legendary creature, Dwarf Berserker. It is a 2/1. It has an anthem effect with other dwarves you control get +1/+0. Whenever a dwarf you control becomes tapped, create a treasure token. Cool, so it is a potential form of ramp. And then it has an activated ability. Sacrifice 5 treasures, search your library for an artifact or dragon card. Put that card onto the battlefield, then shuffle your library. So, as the head of its own deck, that's pretty cool. I don't know if there's enough actual dwarves out there that are good enough to make it work. And while it feels a little bit like Malcolm, a card that obviously I've really been enjoying playing, not having the evasion, any form of evasion, hurts in the ability to actually start getting that mana generated. That activated ability, though, that ability to sacrifice 5 treasures to get potentially game-breaking artifacts or dragons, it seems like a really cool way for a red deck to end the game. At the very least, it works really well in my Torbran deck, where I'm gonna swing with Torbran most days anyway. I might as well get some treasure out of it.
You did mention that most of the dwarves are not particularly impressive, which is true. But you can actually build your own dwarf. A lot of colorless fake lords like Metallic Mimic and those things will gain a creature type when they come into play. So you can play a Metallic Mimic naming dwarf and build your own dwarf, and then use something like Clock of Omens, which lets you untap tapped artifacts. And with a Metallic Mimic, Clock of Omens, and Magda, you can actually wind up getting infinite tapped treasures, which, I mean, tapped is less good, but you can still sacrifice those to tutor for stuff and, have infinite mana the next turn.
All right, Jake, why don't you tell us about the next card that you have in your cart?
All right, the next red card that I have is Birgi, God of Storytelling. Birgi is a legendary creature god for 2 generic and a red, and she is a 3/3. Whenever you cast a spell, add red. Until end of turn, you don't lose this mana as steps and phases end. Also, creatures you control can boast twice during each of your turns rather than once. The backside is Harnfell, Horn of Bounty. For 4 generic and a red, it is a legendary artifact, and it reads, discard a card, exile the top 2 cards of your library. You may play those cards this turn.
Yeah, as we said during our review of all the gods just throughout Magic's history, both of those sides are really good.
Yeah, the front side is basically a cost reducer and turns all your free spells into little mini red rituals. The artifact side will let you dig really deep if you have a grip of cards, so you can try to find a real card that you're looking for, or something specific. Or sometimes your combo attempt will just fiddle and you'll wind up having a grip of cards and have to very sadly pass the turn, but Harnfell can help you recover from that.
Yeah, I want to get a copy for Torbran. Again, it's just a lot of my effects are going to re need red mana, and being able to just get the spotted, the extra red mana for all of my spells probably gets the deck going a little bit more quickly. And then Harnfell, the horn on the backside, is just another way to see more cards as I'm starting to get into the late game.
Yeah, I really like the flexibility of this card. A lot of the cards from this set I'm enjoying because they're incredibly flexible. The front half for Birgi can help you develop, the back half can help you once you're established. Plus, the showcase art's pretty cool.
Yeah. Jake, I think you've got our next card as well that you wanted to tell us about, an uncommon.
I do. There's a lot of red cards for me this time. Dual Strike is an instant for red-red. Whenever you cast your next instant or sorcery spell with converted mana cost 4 or less this turn, copy that spell. You may choose new targets for the copy. And it also has Foretell for red.
The single red foretell cost of it does make that look really appealing.
Yeah, it's, again, this is another really flexible card. You can double anybody's, or I'm sorry, you can double your removal or card draw or tutors. As long as it's two-hand tutor, you probably should not double up on like a vampiric tutor. That would be silly. You can also use it to try and force through like one of your really important spells by putting 2 copies of it on the stack so that they have to counter 2 copies. You can also copy your own counters, so if you want to get your own little miniature Flusterstorm going on. I'm going to pick this up for my Neheb deck. Again, because of the flexibility, I can copy the Flame Rift effects and use those as a ritual effect, or some of the extra attack steps will be covered by this, that kind of stuff.
Very nice. Well, why don't I quickly go through our next card, since this is a god that we talked about at some length during our last episode. I'm going to cover Torolf, God of Fury, somewhat quickly. So Torolf is 2 and 2 red mana for a legendary creature god. It is a 5/4 with trample. Whenever a creature or planeswalker an opponent controls is dealt excess non-combat damage, Torolf deals damage equal to the excess to any target other than that permanent. On the other side, we have Torolf's Hammer. It is 1 and a red for a legendary artifact equipment. Equipped creature has 1 and a red. Tap unattached Torolf's Hammer. It deals 3 damage to any target. Return Torolf's Hammer to its owner's hand. Equipped creature gets +3/+0 as long as it's legendary, and the equipped cost is 1 and a red. So I want to put this card into Torbran. Torbran might be an attacky style deck, but so much of the damage that it usually winds up dealing is non-combat damage, whether from an effect like Pyrohemia, whether from an effect like Raid Bombardment and Cavalcade of Calamity type effects, non-combat damage tends to be a big part of the deck. And being able to essentially multiply those non-combat damages that are being dealt to my opponent's creatures, well, there's no kill like overkill, and Torbran gets to attack 2 onto each instance of that overkill.
Seems good.
And speaking of seems good, why don't we just keep moving right along? Jake, you had another red card you wanted to bring up, another red card with a foretell cost of red.
Yeah, so this is Crush the Weak, a sorcery for 2 generic and a red. Crush the Weak deals 2 damage to each creature. If a creature dealt damage this way would die this turn, exile it instead. And as you mentioned, it's foretell for a single red. Another Pyroclasm. Pyroclasms are pretty strong in certain metas with lots of little creatures. There's even more little creatures that are being printed, like Opposition Agent and Hull Breacher. So this is a potentially good card if you want to increase the density of Pyroclasms in your deck.
And the flexibility of being able to put it on layaway one turn and save it for later to be able to cast it for a single red mana, similar to Doomscar, it then means you are the first person rebuilding afterwards.
Yep. And also the incidental value you can get from exiling creatures.
Yeah.
I believe that was the last card in red, so I guess we're going into green, which means we need to wake up Alex and have him talk about something.
Oh, I'm prepared. I'm
looking over some of the cards you selected. I think you are very prepared.
All right, so starting green and just coming out the bat swinging with this one, Vorinclix, Monstrous Raider. So aside from all the lore possibilities that he opens up for the Magic story, it has the one aspect of doubling season just stapled onto it. If you get to put a number of counters on a permanent, put that twice that many on there, which is fun. So the ability to have planeswalkers come in at a higher loyalty, distribute +1/+1 counters at a higher quantity is beneficial. The fact that it's stuck onto a 6/6 trample haste isn't bad. If that's where the card ended, that would be fine. It would still do something that I would want in the decks that I utilize it in. And the downside of it being attached on a creature that could just be path exiled or destroyed or murdered is a worthwhile risk. But it has another aspect on it. If an opponent would put a 1 or more counters on a permanent or a player, they put half that many on each of those permanents, those kinds of counters on permanent instead. What I've noticed of this card in Brawl is it completely shuts off planeswalkers.
A lot of planeswalkers that are upticking at +1, now it rounds down instead, so it is 0. Jake, do you have anything else you would like to say about Vorinclix before we move on?
I do not. Let's talk about Finn the Fangbearer.
Yeah, Finn the Fangbearer. So it is 1 and a green for a 1/3 legendary creature human warrior with Death Touch. Whenever a creature you control with Death Touch deals combat damage to a player, that player gets 2 poison counters. This card just seems like it could be really fun in a green-black Death Touch Matters kind of deck.
Yeah, I'm putting him into my Habatra deck, which is not really a surprise, because Death Touch Snakes, yep, good stuff.
And speaking of not a surprise, Alex, you're going to tell us about an Elf Lord.
I am. Elf Lord Plus. So next card is Canopy Tactician. It is a 4-mana Elf Lord. If it were simply just a 4-mana Elf Lord, that would be nothing to write home about. In fact, it would actually just be a bad card. But this 4-mana Elf Lord can also tap for 3. So it is a 4-mana 3-3 that gives other elves +1/+1, and it itself taps for 3 green. It could be cheaper. Still not a stellar Elf Lord as compared to some of the other ones that exist out there, like Elvish Archdruid. However, it's not bad either. So for that reason, it is going to at least see somewhat of an experimentation play in the elf decks that I have, just to see if it makes a difference. Now, I know there is something that John wants to talk about before it comes back to me. I would, however, like to kind of break that a little bit and talk about why this card could be better.
Sure.
Compared to another card that was spoiled. Now, we've talked about Planeswalkers not being super prevalent in EDH, and there are some that kind of, you know, do show up and kind of make a case for themselves. This Planeswalker is probably the one I've been most excited about in a long time for any deck that I want, and that's Tyvar Kell. He is an Elf Matters Planeswalker, with 4 mana, comes in at 3 starting loyalty. Introduced in War of the Spark, he has a passive ability, in which elves you control have tap, add black mana. So, most of the elves that do exist add mana in and of themselves, this just means they also tap for black. Plus one ability puts a +1/+1 counter on a target elf on tap, it gains death touch until end of turn. So, it puts a +1/+1 counter on something, and essentially just means that I have the ability to tap an elf for mana, +1, untap it, tap it again for mana. So, it is a form of ramp in and of itself. Coupled with his passive of elves you control add black, it essentially means any elf I control that isn't summoning sick can generate 2 mana. So there is something to be said of there. He has a 0, which just means put an elf or a creature onto the battlefield. Creature token, which means with its ability and the following turn, it can tap for 2 mana. So it is a form of weird creature ramp in and of itself. The part that super excites me is the -6, his emblem ability, which is you get an emblem with whenever you cast an elf spell, it gains haste until end of turn and you draw 2 cards.
So that means you can drop red, which is usually one of your requirements lately for your Elf Ball decks.
Yeah, mainly simply for Rhythm of the Wild. I mean, that card in itself pretty much makes you want to have red, because Rhythm of the Wild is super strong. But having an emblem wherever you play an F spell, it gains haste and draw 2 cards in a deck that predominantly features low-cost mana-tapping elves is kind of a big thing. In Brawl and in Limited, this is a powerful effect. In Commander, in decks that focus on playing Elf Ball-like strategies and build around it, it's just freaking bonkers.
I'd be careful about overselling it just purely on the ultimate.
Oh no, it is amazing in all regards. Turning any elf into a mana dork, making those mana dorks tap for 2, essentially, because of his ability. Making it so that if you don't have mana dorks, you can just make one out of anywhere. For 4 mana, he does a lot, and the decks that want to utilize effects like that can utilize it to great effect. Alright, so back to Tribal. Elvish Warmaster. 2 mana, 2-2. Whenever one or more elves enter the battlefield under your control, create a 1-1 elf warrior creature token. This ability only triggers once each turn. That there is appealing. It's a 2-2 body for whenever an elf enters the battlefield under your control. The two biggest things about this is, one, it can be on every turn, so not just mine, it can be on my opponent's, and two, it doesn't care if it's a token or if I didn't cast it. If we cycle back to anything else that just generates an elf, it's like, okay, so I play an Elvish Mystic, it generates a +1/+1 creature token, or elf warrior token. That's great.
A 1-1, not a +1/+1.
A 1-1. I cast Elvish Warmaster while I have Tyvar Kell in play. I use Tyvar 0 to put an elf token into play. It triggers Elvish Warmaster. I get another 1-1 elf warrior token. It doesn't care where the elf comes from, simply that it comes into play. Happens once each turn. It's similar to Lissalana Huntsmaster, where whenever an elf comes into play, you get, or whenever you cast an elf spell, you get a 1-1 elf warrior token. But Lissalana Huntsmaster is 4 mana, this is 2. And it also has an additional ability. For 7 mana, elves you control get +2/+2 and gain death touch until end of turn. So while the +2/+2 may not be a lot in and of itself, the death touch pretty much means that if you're going to swing in, you're killing stuff.
Yeah, it's the engine card that's going to get you bodies, and it's the payoff that's going to provide the overrun effect. Well, from the world of wild and crazy death-touching elves, why don't we check in with what Jake has next for us?
Wild and death-touching squirrels?
Close. Next up is Toski, Toski? I don't know. Bearer of Secrets. It's a legendary creature squirrel for 3 generic and a green. It is a 1/1 for 4 mana. What a bargain. This spell can't be countered. Indestructible. Toski, Bearer of Secrets, attacks each combat if able. All that is terrible. But finally we have, whenever a creature you control deals combat damage to a player, draw a card.
We have seen how good that effect can be on Timna.
Yes, and this is even less limited than Timna is, because that's only once per opponent.
And you have to pay life for it.
So, green has had a couple of these coastal piracy effects in the past, like Orin Frostfang, and I guess there was the one for the snakes that's on that, like, 6-mana snake lord or whatever. But this is a lot more reasonable. It's kind of obnoxious for people to deal with, because it is a 1-1 uncounterable indestructible, so you're just going to be swinging it in, hopefully, at somebody that doesn't have a blocker. But yeah, it's for any, like, go wide, or honestly, any green deck that has creatures. This could be a potential draw engine. I am putting it in my Hapatra deck.
Yeah, I want to put this one into my Krom and Kodama deck, because that deck is basically just card draw tribal at this point. And the more cards I can have in hand to vomit onto the table with Kodama, the better. It may actually replace a Coastal Piracy effect in the deck, because it is also a creature.
Yeah, that's another good point. It's a lot easier for green to tutor out creatures than it is for, like, blue to get enchantments.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about, alluded to the sagas so far as we've gone through this. Alex, why don't you take it away with our first multicolor card with a saga?
It is. Forging of the Tyrite Sword is a 3-mana, 1-red-white saga, and it's pretty straightforward. Chapters 1 and 2, generate a treasure token. Chapter 3, search our library for a god named Halvark, God of Battle, which we talked about earlier, or an equipment card. Reveal it, put it into your hand, then shelf your library. In Boros, and in Voltron deck specifically, it simply just reads, 3-mana ramp, ramp again, tutor for an equipment. It's great.
First two turns, it's acting like a mana rock, and then you get the tutor effect directly into hand.
So, okay, maybe you might want Halvar for some reason, because once again, we talk about Halvar's B-plus effect of taking an enchantment already attached to a creature and moving it to something else, or simply just being, okay, here's a 2-1 or +2/+0 vigilance artifact, and if the creature dies, well, it comes back again. But it gives you options if you want Halvar or if you want another piece of equipment, which in my case, realistically speaking, is always going to be one of two things. It's either going to be Sword of the Animus or Sword of Feast and Famine.
I mean, all of those are good things to go get.
Yes.
Yeah, that's not too bad. I was initially kind of downplaying this one because, well, you get rid of the treasure token, but realistically for two turns, it fills the role of a mana rock while you are getting the rest of your game plan set up. And then by the time you're quote-unquote done with it, two turns later, you probably have other things going for you. You don't need the mana rock necessarily at that point, and that's when you get the equipment. And having another equipment tutor, sure, red-white is probably happy for that. Now, Jake, we do have a card on here that we're still debating the merits of.
Yeah, so next up is Valky, God of Lies. It's a modal double-faced card. On the front side, it is a legendary creature god for 1 generic and a black for a 2-1. When Valky enters the battlefield, each opponent reveals their hand. For each opponent, exile a creature card they revealed this way until Valky leaves the battlefield. And then an activated ability for X generic. Choose a creature card exiled with Valky with converted mana cost to X. Valky becomes a copy of that card. The backside is Tybalt, Cosmic Imposter for 5 generic, black, and red. A legendary planeswalker Tybalt with starting loyalty of 5. As Tybalt enters the battlefield, you get an emblem with, you may play cards exiled with Tybalt, Cosmic Imposter, and you may spend mana as though it were mana of any color to cast those spells. Oh, these cards have so many words. The plus 2 ability is, exile the top card of each player's library. His minus 3 is exile target artifact or creature. And his minus 8 is exile all cards from all graveyards, add red, red, red. So, I want to like this card. The front side is cheap. It gives you early information about your opponent's hands. You can snipe some of the creatures out of their hands that they may have been relying on for early game stuff, and give you access to their dorks or stacks or value pieces. the backside can do an imitation of Paco and basically let you draw an extra 4 cards every turn, which is a lot of cards. And also, it's, you know, can serve as removal for an artifact or creature that you can then play yourself. But man, 7 mana is a lot.
The one upside to it is you have the emblem once you've resolved Tybalt. So even if they get rid of Tybalt, you can still cast cards exiled with Tybalt.
Yeah. Well, you can play the cards, not cast them. So you can't get other people's lands for what little that matters.
It just does so much. There's got to be something there. I mean, 7 mana is a lot. 7 mana is a lot.
So yeah, for 7 mana, you cast this, you draw 4 cards, and then you have a 7 loyalty planeswalker, which is not insignificant. Like, that's going to take at least a couple creatures dedicated to whacking your planeswalker.
Mm-hmm.
Which, better? I don't know. It's one of those cards I'm going to probably pick one of these up. I don't know if I'm going to play it, but I want to.
Yeah, I feel like this card should almost get just its whole own episode trying to dissect it. Alex, you've got another legendary creature for us to talk about next as we start winding down.
Cole the Forgemaster is a 2/2 for 2 red-white legendary creature dwarf warrior. Whenever another non-token creature you control dies, if it was enchanted or equipped, return to its owner's hand. That may sound familiar because it is the worthwhile text on the back of Halvar on the Sword of the Realms. It doesn't protect itself, unfortunately, which is kind of unfortunate, but it does give an effect that kind of protects against wraths and things of that nature for equipped Voltron decks. And pretty much just, it also, in a weird way, kind of eats a removal spell to where, okay, if they want to destroy your equipped creature and make sure that it doesn't come back to bother them next turn, they have to deal with Cole first. So it eats a removal spell on that accent. As a side note, creature tokens you control that are enchanted or equipped get +1/+1. I'm here for the first part. The second part is kind of just, that might be relevant one day, but it's not here now.
In the command zone or in the 99?
In the 99, always.
Okay, because I was going to say it doesn't really synergize with itself in the command zone too well. No,
this is always in the 99.
I also want to do a quick shout out to another one of these uncommon two-color legends in Cardor the Doom Scourge. He is, or potentially she, is a 4 mana, so 2, a black and a red, for a 4/3 legendary creature Demon Berserker. When Cardor the Doom Scourge enters the battlefield until your next turn, creatures your opponents control attack each combat if able, and attack a player other than you if able. So that is goad. Whenever an attacking creature dies, not just your attacking creatures, but any creature declared as an attacker dies, each opponent loses 1 life and you gain 1 life. This seems like a deck that I do want to break my rule and build just because it is a potentially reasonably low-powered deck that will get the game going. It will break board stalemates. It being a goad effect also synergizes nicely with a potentially, I guess, aggressive red-black deck build. So it could easily be the lead singer for that Berserker deck. But just any aggressive red-black deck would probably be very happy to have shields down on all of your opponents. And once you start getting the party going, it doesn't matter if your creatures are dying on the attack, if other people's creatures are dying on the attack, it's going to wear people down. And that's just a cool way to speed the game along, which sometimes at lower power games is exactly what the game needs.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd be interested to play against that deck.
In our meta in particular, there's a lot of creature-based decks, and Cardor could really get things moving nicely. And speaking of creature-based decks, Alex, it would not be a what's in our cart for the year of 2021, the year of Tribal, unless we closed with another Tribal card.
All right. And this actually is a Commander card. It is the headliner for the Kaldheim Elf Commander deck. It's Lathril, Blade of the Elves. At first blush, it has a lot with another elf that exists out there, Tana the Bloodsower. Both are 4 mana, and both have an ability where whenever this creature deals combat damage to a player, you create X of a specific kind of token. For Tana, it's Sepperling tokens. For Lathril, it's specifically Green Elf Warrior tokens. It rewards both of them for dealing combat damage, and it you hit it, like Sonic, just rings pop out everywhere. In this case, it's elves pop out everywhere. Tana has Trample, which is good in and of itself. However, Lathril has a more, at least personally, sought-after form of evasion in Menace. Lathril comes down. The next turn, if an opponent only has a single creature, you're getting in there for two with Menace and generating two 1/1 green elf creature tokens. That in itself is appealing. I like that. It does something that I want it to do. It also has another activated ability. Tap, and then tap 10 under elves you control. Each opponent loses 10 life and you gain 10 life.
That seems weird for a green card.
It does. It seems weird for a green card, but not for a black card.
Okay, so this is a green and black elf, yes. Then.
Yes. Sorry. First thing that came to mind is, how can I take ridiculous advantage of this using something like this and then Rise of the Redeemed? I saw this card spoiled and my mind went into, okay, what's the fastest way I can build an unnecessary amount of tokens and then activate this ability more than once? You know, first thing came to mind, like, let's do things with Rise. Or is there things that we can utilize Lithoform Engine for, or other effects that double triggered abilities that came into mind? And then it's like, cool, is there a way I can build this into a deck that has blue so I can use Intruder Alarm to get additional effects? Right now, I'm sitting on a Abzan shell, taking advantage of just Lathril and other token generate effects and untap effects to kind of get to where I want to be. The biggest challenge I've encountered with that, though, is the lack of red for Rhythm of the Wild specifically, and the lack of blue for specifically Intruder Alarm. So I'm trying to come up with something that just is, and it's very typical in my way of doing things, to where I want a tuned, powerful deck, not CDH specific, that just has a lots of moving parts, where the more I add to the board state, the more complex and more triggered interactions there have. And this is probably, I want to say, the most ambitious deck I've tried to brew outside of an existing shell. It's very reminiscent of my original teamer list when I first met you, John.
Mm-hmm.
Where every single piece in the deck has a purpose and triggers into something else. Right now it just feels clunky. So I'm trying to shave away and streamline it as much as I possibly can. And really try and talk myself out of just making Kenrith the commander so I have specific access. Like, I would run Kenrith only to have access to Rhythm of the Wilds and Intruder Alarm. Like, there'd be no other red or blue cards. There would literally just be those two. But right now, I think I've narrowed on Kodama of the East Tree and Dimna, which are both things I want to do. Right now, it's just trimming the fat and figure out where I want to be. So there's a lot going on. My Moxfield tentative list has like 300 cards for it right now.
Oh, God.
I mean, it's a huge freaking design space, at least for what I enjoy doing with decks. It's definitely grasped my attention more so than any deck I've built in a while. Even more so than Landfall, so.
I'm looking forward to seeing what you do with this one.
Me too, because like, I want to see something come of it.
There's a lot of cool stuff coming out of this set overall. But you know, there's one more cool thing we have to get out of this episode. And that's our hot seat.
And I think we're breaking records for me having it 2 weeks in a row.
All right, hit us with your hot seat question, Alex.
All right, so now that Nicol Bolas has been taken care of and is being babysat by Ugin somewhere, like some sort of like featherless chicken, with Kaldheim, it introduces a new threat, or I should say a returning threat, in the way of the Phyrexians, because you kind of a head-scratcher, what on earth is Vorinclex doing here? And while Nicol Bolas had these grand, crazy schemes of everything working under his rim, the Phyrexians are much more straightforward. We want to perfect everything with the glistening oil. Fantastic. So, we have this reintroduced threat to the multiverse, and obviously we need a new team to counteract this new threat to the multiverse. With Kaldheim, and something we talked about in our last episode, there are some semblances between the gods that exist here in Kaldheim and some fan-favorite pulp culture gods, Odin, Thor, Loki, which are all, fun fact, appear in the Marvel Avengers universe. If we were going to create our own team of Avengers with existing Magic characters, who would be their in-game counterparts? And the two that come to mind for me to kind of set the example is Iron Man would most obviously be Karn as a man of iron. And okay. Black Widow could probably be Belby or Zansha as the Black Widow-esque. So my question would be, if we were building a Magic-esque team of Avengers, who would be whom?
I guess Omnath could be the Hulk because he is green and has unbounded levels of power.
And anger. Yeah, I like that. Obviously, Torolf is very much just Thor. Let's see, who else can we get there? Captain America, we've got someone who is all about shielding and protection. You could probably make the argument for any number of white creatures throughout Magic's history. Possibly the Gerard card, the Boros version of Gerard Weatherlight Captain from one of the recent Commander sets.
I'm surprised you didn't just go straight with Gideon.
Yeah, but that's a planeswalker. It's not a creature.
True.
I'm going with creatures. I'm trying to be...
Well,
to be...
technically, Gideon turns into planes to a creature fairly often.
Yeah, but you can't tutor him up with a worldly tutor. Okay, so that... that's Cap. Who would be Hawkeye?
See, this it took me a while to deliver what the question was, but it provokes thought, and it's nerdy, and I enjoy that. So any question that comes from me is going to be Vorthos-related.
So Hawkeye would probably not necessarily have to be just an archer. It would have to be someone with a toolbox strapped to their back. I would go with Yi-San as our version of Hawkeye.
Yeah, if, like,
just
I'm
able to
Hawkeye...
pull any tool out of his bag to feel to fix the problem.
It has to be versatile, and it has to be precise, which Yi-San is perfect for that. It is very specific what you're getting, and it's very precise in how it's done.
Mm-hmm. And then that leaves... So are we doing just Marvel Cinematic Universe?
It can be any of the Avengers from the Cinematic Universe. So just like anything that appears in Endgame.
Let's see here. Black Panther, we've basically got... He's equipped to the gills. He is an unstoppable fighter. He is just all kinds of awesome.
It's Kamal.
Yeah. I can get behind that one. As much as the obvious Lord Windgrace. Again, Lord Windgrace is a planeswalker at the moment. Doctor Strange. Jake, any thoughts on who we could get for Doctor Strange? There's a lot of wizards we can pull on.
Tygam?
Yeah, I like kind of any version of Tygam there. Just, no, I'm going to do my thing and you can't stop me. And the whole temporal manipulation.
Jace would be a runner-up. Jace and Teferi both are creature cards.
They have both been creature cards before. And then, let's see here, Spider-Man. What do we got for Spider-Man? That one's tougher. It would probably just be something almost... What is the best version of a tap down that we have? Like the best master decoy effect.
Frost Titan.
Are you sure it wouldn't just be Ishkana?
Yeah, that works too. I'm fine with Ishkana.
Yeah, I mean, it can be thematic. It can be functional.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that Star-Lord is actually just Squee.
Yeah. kind of the whole... Honestly, you could just put Squee in for the entire Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, except you could have...
Multani as Groot.
That's the kind of answer that this question I wanted to inspire. It's like, what is the obvious? Multani's Groot.
Toski is Rocket.
We're cooking with gas.
Then that kind of gets us down to the last couple of bare bones. We did have Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers, in the most recent Endgame, who is just basically an unstoppable tank in the air. So why don't we just go with Akroma?
Akroma, yeah.
That works.
So the real question is here, is Nick Fury Urza?
I don't feel like Nick Fury has committed enough atrocities.
It's fair, but he's done the preparation. He's done the planning for the inevitable, so.
Yeah. No, I think that kind of covers our Avengers dream team here. Alex, you're going to have to work pretty hard to top this hot seat question for next time.
I mean, next time I think of something that's relatively nerdy that relates to magic and pulp culture, I'll think of something. But I think I'm spent. Like, I had my God one, and I've got this one. So I think I'm good. I've hit my quota for, like, the first half of 2021. So I think we're good.
All right. Why don't we bring this episode to a close then? As I said, you can get at us on Twitter. You can leave us a comment. Be sure to like and subscribe. Send us an email. Let us know what you think, whether it's about any other cards from this set that are in your carts that we may have missed, or any other Avengers we didn't talk about in our wonderful hot seat topic. Until next time, I'm John.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Jake.
You can reach the crew from Gemstone Mine on Twitter at GemstoneMineMTG or send us an email at GemstoneMinePodcast@gmail.com. On YouTube, we're Gemstone Mine Podcast. Be sure to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell.